Hi, everybody. Welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballengee. It's good to have you here on today's show. This is my pre-birthday show. I'm turning 40 on April 30th. I don't think of it as a huge deal, but I've been told it's a big deal to turn 40. That's great that I've probably lived about half of my lifespan. Hopefully plenty to go. We've got plenty to talk about in golf, so I'm going to spend some time of that 40-whatever years, hopefully, that are left. And we're going to have a good time talking golf today. We've got a whole bunch of different things to get to, kind of a mishmash of things. I do want to start actually about playing golf. I've not really played a whole lot of golf this year, to be honest with you. When Dottie died a couple of weeks ago, that was when we were on vacation. I was supposed to play golf that week. Obviously, that did not happen. Didn't play the week of the Masters, didn't play before that. I wound up playing on Monday. This past Monday. And a buddy of mine, a bunch of them are in a four-person league at a local muni course, and they needed a sub for the one night. And I've told them in the past, and I've done it before, hey, like, if you need somebody to come in on a Monday night, I'll come and play golf with you anytime. Nice nine-hole league. We had a great time. But I hadn't played probably 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks. I think 3 weeks. And maybe closer to four. And it was so... There was so much freedom in playing nine holes having not played in a while. And it was really strange. I mean, you can go look me up on Gin if you want. I'm a decent player. I mean, I don't think I'm as good as what my handicap says, but I'm a pretty good player. And I feel like I am playing better golf now than I have at any point in my life. And part of it is I think I play golf slightly, not much, smarter than I used to. And over the history of me playing golf, I have always been more entertained by hero shots and trouble shots and not necessarily scoring, but just finding ways to do weird things that are different and that don't happen that often. Because if you're a good player, pars are pretty common. If you're a bogey golfer, obviously, bogeys are pretty common. So the things that might excite you are things that don't happen, or the things that get your attention are things that don't happen that often. So finding a water hazard, hopefully doesn't happen that often to you, doesn't to me. Making birdies, they're still exciting. I still love making birdies because most of the time I play golf, I don't make birdies. If I'm playing well, I make, you know, 16, 17 pars and a birdie or two. Or maybe I make like 14 pars and two bogeys and a birdie, and something like that. I don't know. I'm not adding the 18 very well here, but what has always interested me about golf was the rare, not the commonplace, not a solid round where I hit 18 greens in regulation, which I don't think I've ever done, but hit a lot of greens in regulation, two putted a whole bunch of holes and made it look very ho hum. That just does not get my attention. But I feel like I have come to find a happy medium when I play golf the last few years of still chasing, you know, trying to get the par fives and two, trying to drive those shorter par fours when I have those opportunities, trying to make, I mean, I love putting. Putting is my favorite thing. Putting and chipping is my favorite thing, even though I'm a power player, but it's my favorite thing because there's the most imagination involved. Out of the regular shots, right? I mean, trouble shots, those are my favorite. If golf were just standing behind a tree, dropping a ball, and finding a way to hit a green, I would play more golf. I love that about it. And the mundane, all right, hit it in the fairway, hit the middle of the green, that doesn't really do it for me, but I've come to realize that you have to do that a good chunk of the time because you just can't get to a pin, or because you didn't execute the shot previously very well. So you've got to kind of take your medicine, and that doesn't mean chipping out or whatever. That just means taking the path of least resistance to the green. And that has netted out some really great scores, because not because I'm making more birdies. I mean, I do have some days, and I'll talk about this in a little bit, but I do have some days where just everything goes in and it's incredible. But... And I'm sure you have those days too, where no matter your skill level, things go right that don't typically go right, put it that way. But I have realized that the path to the best scoring is to be okay with mundane sometimes and find the holes and find the spots after a good tee shot or whatever where I can be aggressive and then play to that and see if I can make something of those opportunities instead of trying to make 18 holes into 18 potential birdies. Realize that, particularly on my home course that obviously I know really well and played it 12 years, there are just certain places on the golf course where it's going to be unlikely for me to make a birdie for whatever reason, but it's pretty easy to make a par. So try to make the par, and if you get lucky, then you make the birdie. There are a bunch of holes at my club that are birdie holes. Some are there are a couple drivable par fours. We have really fun back nine. We have some shortish par fives. We have three on the course. Two are pretty easily gettable. One's got to hit a really good drive. Well, pretty solid drive to get there. So those are birdie holes, two of the three, if not three of the three. But if you do really well, then you can make an eagle. And so you play to make the birdie. And if you don't, that's okay. But I feel like I've seen the most success in my game in not necessarily meeting those expectations. You know, oh, well, you can birdie every hole. You're powerful enough. You're a skilled enough player. But really to temper expectations and try to execute each shot one at a time. And the cliche of one shot at a time works. And trying not to think ahead. And I've known this because I've been punished to myself over the years when, you know, I'm in a good place through six holes or seven holes. And I think, well, if I play the next 11, 12 holes in whatever score, I can shoot this. Even though there's a long way between where I am on the golf course and that end score on the scorecard. And yesterday, or Monday rather, I came out having not swung a golf club in probably 2 or 3 weeks, maybe longer. And I felt like I was totally free of any expectation of, hey, these are, and I just went to the first tee thinking, these are the things you know worked last time and other, you know, recent subsequent times. Just do those. Stick with those and then adjust. And I never really had to adjust. Yeah, I've been working really hard for a long time on trying to be comfortable hitting a fade. And being comfortable hitting a draw is not that hard to do. But trying to switch between the two is tricky. I've always had trouble trying to decide at the start of a round, okay, what am I going to try to do? Am I going to try to hit a cut all day? Or am I going to try to draw it all day? And the times over the years where I, especially as I've tried to figure this out, okay, well, I need a cut on this hole and I want to draw on this hole. That has been tricky. But the last two times out, it's finally starting to click. And I think part of that is being okay with the result maybe not working, but also just starting to feel comfortable with the idea of focusing on that one thing. Like, don't worry about where the ball goes necessarily. Proven to myself over time, I can keep it between trees. Just think about delivering the shot as you want, delivering the club as you want to deliver it to get the result that you want. And it has been incredibly freeing. And I didn't know what I would do score-wise. I mean, it's worked out very well the last two times I played. Almost had a career low round yesterday. Made five birdies and an eagle or something like that. I mean, it was pretty ridiculous. It was pretty ridiculous golf. And I was thrilled with, again, creating the opportunity. Not, instead of viewing golf scoring as something you have to do, almost viewing it as the opposite. And I say all of that because it made me think of something Max Homa said going into the Masters, where obviously he was installed as one of the favorites. Didn't live up to that, but pre-tournament he was asked about that, about being someone now suddenly considered a favorite for a major and someone that is expected to do well in them moving forward because of what he's done in regular PGA Tour events the last 18, 24 months. And he said he didn't really want to change expectations and want to create a level of expectation around performance because then that takes away the joy of performing well. And I thought that was a really brilliant way to put what we get to experience in golf. That if you put in the work and you put in the time and you get better and you do the right things, whether it's on the course or on the driving range or both, eventually, if you're doing it right, I think, you can build up to a point where, not that you can expect more of yourself, but that the results are more gratifying. And if you walk onto the first tee of anything, whether that's a weekend round or something that counts or whatever, and you think, I'm going to shoot this score. This is what I want to shoot. This is what would be my acceptable score. The whole old Bryson par 67 thing at Augusta National. You put that out into the universe and you put it into your brain and you go, well, this would be a good result. Well, all of a sudden there's pressure from the start. And when you start on the first tee and go, well, whatever happens today happens, but I believe in my skill set. I believe in my preparation. I believe in what I've done to get to here. And that has well prepared me to do whatever I've got to do here to be successful, whatever that gauge is. And that's really worked out the last, more than a year. But having come back to it after 3 or 4 weeks off and coming back to it and feeling just so free, instead of, oh, you haven't played in a while, it's a lot of, and you've agreed to sub into this league, it's a lot of pressure, you got to do this, this, and this. None of that had to happen. It worked out great just being able to play golf. And I was able to work the ball both ways, particularly with the driver, pretty decently with the irons, getting there. And I feel like I have found another wrinkle of golf that I love. And that is what endlessly fascinates me about this game, is that I can find something that captures my attention and interest as I get older, as my skill set changes or develops or regresses in places. And I'm still learning stuff all the time about golf that really makes me excited. Really makes me excited. So all that to say, I don't even really know why I'm saying that necessarily, other than I just needed to tell somebody that, golf's a whole lot of fun right now. And it's always been fun, but I feel like kind of getting to that zen place with it where, because I feel comfortable, because I feel good on the golf course, making good decisions, having a good idea of what I'm trying to do, it just works out better. And I say that even as I'm making changes in how I approach a couple different holes on our golf course. So over the, I guess it was the fall maybe, we did this thing called micro drainage on our greens. And we'd done this to a bunch of them before, but hadn't done all of them. And the idea was to take off the top, the grass, the turf, in small, I think they're 6-inch wide or so, increments, strips. Digging the dirt out, and putting in, gravel. And then covering it and building up the base so you could have the turf there. And the idea is that, we have clay base, so it's very hard to drain the greens at times, especially when it rains a lot. And so this micro drainage really helps it drain quickly, and it maintains its speed, and if not, it gets firmer and faster because it doesn't hold the water as much. And we did that to all of the greens that hadn't been done on before. And it had radically transformed several of the greens on the course that were notoriously slow and soft, and turned them into some of the faster greens on the course. Well, now we have it on all of them. But I hadn't really played since they started to mature. And now we have two very different holes because of the greens. And that change really caught me off guard yesterday. We have two holes back to back. These are the holes on the course I'm changing the strategy on. So 14 is about 315 yards from the tips. It's a pretty straight hole in terms of, if you could just hit a driver dead straight, or whatever, I guess if you're the young kids hit 3 woods, which is unbelievable. But if you could hit a club, 300 in the air, you've got it, whatever that is. Or you can run it up. There's two bunkers. The fairway goes out to the right. It's not really a dog leg, but it's out to the right situated. And then there's trees parallel to the green complex out to the right, so you can't just blast it and then chip over. And there are two bunkers to the left, which really is just straight onto the target, straight onto the green. If you hit over them, then you would have a really easy straight-up approach. Or if you hit short of them, you have an easy straight-up approach. And for years, I just tried to drive the green with driver in hand, thinking, if I hit the green, right, thinking about the optimal result happening every time, which is obviously not the case, then I would hit the green and have an eagle putt, and it will work out great. And I think I've eagled the hole like twice, maybe three times, doing it this way. I've chipped in for eagle more often than I've done it this way. And my error would be, well, I'll hit it into the woods to the right of the green, and now I've got a like 20-yard shot, but I've got to chip it, and the green goes away from you. It's just a bad idea. And so I thought at the start of this year, let's change. Clearly, that's not delivering the results that you want. Change. And I thought, okay, well, I hit my longest iron, which is like a 2 hybrid iron, one of those empty, you know, hollow irons, hollow body irons. And hit it down to the end of the fairway, left like 50, 60 yards. Nipped a lovely chip. I thought, man, this is going to be great. Be close, easy birdie, good strategy change. Rolled off the green. Well, stayed on the green by an inch. Almost off the green. And I couldn't believe it. It was because the micro drainage had firmed up the greens to the point that, I mean, it's not normally like that. And all of a sudden, that angle became bad. And now I have to rethink what I was rethinking. I have to think, okay, well, maybe if I can get a club, whatever that is, over those two bunkers, a little downslope, chip on. Or do I lay up short of it and just leave a straight up 75, 80 yard wedge shot? And I really like that about the change, that it has made the hole harder. It's going to make me think more on the golf course. Next hole is straight hole 360, about 240, 250 off the tee. Starts to dip down into a valley. The valley comes to like a little creek that's been covered in the fairway width, but to the left is a little bit of creek. To the right is some trees in a creek that kind of block balls from hitting the 16th tee box via a flail, flailing second shot. And for the last couple of years, same thing. I thought, just drive, hit driver, because there's out of bounds all up the left. It got in my head, and that I would want to, if I took like a 4-iron or a 5-iron, which was the smart play, and tried to hit the fairway, almost inevitably, I would either flare it way right, bad, because I was afraid of pulling it left out of bounds and having to reload. And so I hit driver because I didn't see I didn't experience the hole that way with driver. I could occasionally hit a dead straight and leave basically an uphill chip that gave me a great look at birdie. But that didn't always work. If I hit it too far and hit it too far to the right and bailed, I could go into that creek. And I started going into the creek a little bit more. Variance came into play. So I said, okay, well, this year, I don't think I want to hit the driver. I think I'm going to try the 2-iron. And it seems like that's the play. So I figured out a different way to play this hole. That green is also now super quick, which makes me think a little bit differently about trying to hit the fairway, because the ball may roll out more. And that the putt, if you're a little long of the target, is incredibly quick now. Now, not just quick, but really quick. And again, the changes of the golf course, changes of the strategy, that's really intrigued me. And just trying to get better at golf, trying to be better. And I think the weird thing is, and if you're a younger person, this probably applies to you. If you've played golf a long time, this probably applies to you. We probably have engaged in so much folly over the years over golf strategy, trying to rely on things that we think we can do, but we don't do well enough often enough, and think, well, that's the right way. And you can just salvage pars when it doesn't work, instead of putting yourself in a situation where I think I'm doing now, where I could put myself in a position to be successful more often and maybe even take some of the risk out of it. It's just, and you look back and go, well, I've wasted like a year's worth of playing golf, or 2 years worth of playing golf on this golf course with this strategy, and it wasn't smart. And I think that's another thing. Again, expectations, being smart, understanding how you play golf. And all of that, I feel like, has only come to me through experience, through trial and painful error, and some success. Success has also not helped. When the strategy works, that a failed strategy works, it reinforces that you think it should work, and it doesn't necessarily have to work. It doesn't necessarily have to work. And it takes a long time to undo a bad decision when it starts to work in your favor and shrouds the fact that it is a bad decision. And I think that goes to a lot of life, right? You make bad choices and you don't get in trouble for it. And you think, okay, well, it's got to be okay. It's working out just fine. I'm not in trouble. Nobody's worried about it. And it leads to, I think, even more painful results. And that way, golf is very, very, very much like life. And trying to make good decisions in life is the same thing I'm trying to go through in golf. And I think I'm starting to make smarter ones in life. I mean, business-wise, things are going pretty well. I'm pretty happy with personal choices in life. But I think for a while I made some choices in business that were not bad ones, but they weren't great ones. And I kept doing them because I saw some benefit to them, but not the right amount of benefit. And then eventually came back to these choices and went, wait, what? That's not enough. That's not doing it for me anymore. Nix those. Move to these instead. And that I hope is working. I hope it's working out pretty well. That's a little existential, but the golf piece of it, learning how to make good choices, learning how to be okay with mistakes, learning how to be okay without expectation. And I think that is all translated to some better performance on the golf course. All right, let's shift gears a little bit. I would like to talk about the shift, I guess, to the topic of being live. And if you want to skip this for 10, 12 minutes, I totally understand if this is not your jam. Completely get it. But I was on Twitter yesterday, and I've been on Twitter much less, I feel like, now than ever, even though I'm looking at Twitter as I talk about this. But I don't feel like as I'm engaged in it. It's more of I sit here waiting for news to happen and seeing if it happens to come on my timeline before I get it over email or some other discovery method. But I was on Twitter and I saw a tweet from Dan Rappaport. Dan Rappaport used to work for Golf Digest. He used to be like the Tiger Beat guy. That's kind of how he got his following. And then he went over to Barstool. And he moved to Barstool, I think in part because he thought that was kind of the future things. I mean, I'm not going to go into his personal situation in life, but obviously, as you have seen, if you watched Full Swing, and I'm not assuming you have, but if you've watched the Full Swing documentary, you know he has a very close relationship with Matt Fitzpatrick. I think he found himself in some trouble for being very open about rooting for Matt Fitzpatrick and getting on camera rooting for Matt Fitzpatrick during the U.S. Open, which Fitzpatrick won, but practically celebrating with Matt's family, and that was not a great look. And I think Barstool looks at that quite differently. I mean, they want to be friends with the people that they cover because they're not real. Not that they're not critical. I think that they are critical, but they do it in a different way, I guess. It just lands a little bit differently, I think, for whatever reason. And so he went to Barstool, and now Dan has a battery of takes, right? I mean, some are pretty good. Some get shot down. I'm not really sure how the Barstool audience feels about him. That's not for me to decide. But I saw him tweet that he thinks LIV Golf should get official world golf ranking points. And he has kind of been a bit of a shill for LIV recently. And I'm not exactly sure why. I don't know the exact reason why. I'll kind of speculate about that here in a few. But he tweeted that he thought that this should, the LIV event should get world ranking points because of their performance in the Masters. Because I think it was something like 11 or 12 of the 18 players from LIV made the cut. Now, some of that was thanks to Justin Thomas and Sungjae Im moving the cut line so Tiger can make the cut. Otherwise, I think it would have been a substantially lower number, maybe like 8 or 9. I don't remember exactly. But obviously, a good number of the LIV contingent made cuts. And also, they had 3 players in the top 5. And so he figures that result indicates that they are capable players and therefore live tournaments should get official World Golf ranking points. And I'm not seeing the parallel. I don't see the parallel. I mean, I'm a data guy, right? I mean, I put together models every week of PGA Tour events. I try to compare. I tried to do this before the Masters. I tried to compare LIV tournaments and LIV performance to PGA Tour performance. And while I think it was pretty fair, I came away from the experience of watching the Masters thinking even more, hey, these LIV events really do have random results for whatever reason. Could be the format being 54 holes, could be a shotgun start. There's a lack of awareness about things going on. Could be the team component. Maybe some players play for the team even though they're out of the individual part of it and that works for them. I don't know. Could just be that a lot of these guys have been paid off and they play better golf than maybe they otherwise would because there's really no pressure. They've been paid. They've got more money than they'll ever need. And in many cases, not all. And even if you're like Sawan Kim, who's by far the worst player on LIV, I mean, he's having a hard time this year. He's still going to make a couple million dollars this year finishing DFL in every tournament until he gets a demotion. And that is life-changing money. So even if you're playing awful, and I'm sure he's frustrated by that, still going to be okay, financially speaking. So the pressure, I think, is different for a LIV player trying to win. And the format doesn't seem to lend itself to consistent results. I'm not going to put down Anirban Lahiri, but he's got a couple of runner-up finishes on LIV, if I remember right. That doesn't typically happen or didn't typically happen for Anirban Lahiri on the PGA Tour. I mean, he obviously was runner-up at the Players the year Cam Smith won, and that might have secured him a deal that was too good to pass up. But the format just doesn't seem to scream, hey, we have something that evaluates golf capability really well. I didn't say anywhere in there that the people who have gone to LIV have suddenly found kryptonite and can't be good golfers anymore. I don't think that that's true. And you can even if you wanted to chalk up the performance of Koepka, Reed, and Mickelson to their positive experience for green jackets between them and one almost green jacket for Brooks. Even if you want to chalk it up to them liking the golf course, and I think you can, they still performed well. I don't think they're bad players. I don't think they've all of a sudden become awful golfers. I think they have the capability, but I think the format really just doesn't work in their favor. But I bring all of this up because I think the sports washing may, in some cases, be working. And it's something that I've noticed in how LIV is covered, how LIV is thought of. A lot of the publications overseas, you know, the UK publications that are sizable and popular, they have tried to, I think, cover LIV more. Not that necessarily they like it more. I just think they see a potential audience for it because they maybe don't have the same cultural thoughts about the Saudis. Maybe they do. I don't know. I haven't had that conversation with our friends over there. But I feel like they cover it more. And that has trickled out into how LIV is covered at some publications. I feel like there's been more coverage of it from Digest and Golf.com for sure. There's definitely been more of it in Barstool, for sure. But it seems in some ways that the exercise of LIV just being around has worn down some people to the idea that, okay, well, it's just going to be around. We might as well just give them points and move on. And I think that's exactly what they hoped would happen, that eventually people would just give in and go, you know what, just make them part of it. Just bend to their version of golf and rank it against 72 hole stroke play linear golf and figure it out. And now I found it heartening at the same time to see a lot of the response was no. Why? What a horrible take. What a horrible opinion, because it doesn't make any sense. Liv actively created something that they knew didn't comply with the official World Golf Ranking system, and therefore they shouldn't earn points or the system shouldn't change for them. If anything, they should change the other way, which, by the way, they could fix really easily. They could make it a 4-day thing. I don't know if the shotgun start thing is a deal breaker. I don't think that it is. Maybe it is, but I don't believe that it is against the world ranking criteria. And the team thing is whatever. They're not going to take that away. So if you want them to give the points, then you have it that way. But that the idea of just kind of going, this is our format, we deserve points because we have good golfers, doesn't fly. Because they do have good players, yes. The indictment is the format. The indictment is that you can't just qualify. There's no Monday qualifying for Liv. There's no special invitations to Liv. Like, they've got 48 players and that's it. And that's not changing. And that unto itself actually would hurt them in the official World Golf Ranking, by the way. But hey, whatever. I do find that there has been some wearing down of some criticism about Liv. And part of that, I think, is the natural interest that a lot of people on my side of things have in talking about something that's weird and different and will generate a lot of clicks and get a lot of retweets and engagement, because that's what a lot of people do now. They just try to get people mad or upset or to say they suck or, you know, some kind of engagement, because engagement means that people care. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But I think that the shiny quarter of Liv being out there, even though the ratings are on TV are not very good, and relatively speaking, most people could not care less. This is almost like a weird gap of, you know, when we're talking about it here, because I'm trying to think about more meta issues in golf, not meta Quest, not meta Facebook, but, you know, meta existential type issues. And the wearing down of it, I think, is something worth talking about. But I personally have not changed my views on this. I still cover Liv the same. I recognize that whatever happens with Liv is going to be a part of golf history. And so to memorialize that, however long it is, and it could be 10 years, I mean, I don't know. But to memorialize that, my idea was to have indicated who's playing in the events and how the events finished and how much money each person got for playing in the live events. Because at the end of the day, isn't that what the money's for? Expression kind of carries weight here. And that's what people, I think, are interested in about live. So that's been my choice. I haven't changed it. I don't plan on suddenly talking about Phil Mickelson and the fun, you know, the funny things that might be said during a live news conference or what have you. That's just my MO. And everyone's got their own. Every publisher has their own. Every content creator has their own measure of it. And there are people out there who are all in on live. And there are people out there who are all out. I've tried to be, and this is something I've always tried to do with any topic, is try to be fair, not objective. I don't think people can be objective. And the idea that media is not supposed to have some kind of bias or opinion that informs their content, informs their worldview, I think is stupid and sophomoric to think that. That's not how media ever worked. It's not how it's ever going to work. People have a prism through which they see the world, and that informs what they talk about, why they talk about it, and how they talk about it. Acknowledge those biases. Acknowledge what brings you to the table and what baggage you might carry, positively or negatively, and then you can try to evaluate something. And if you know how you feel or what you think or what you know about something and how that informs your views, then you can hopefully acknowledge the things that might run counter to your philosophy, your viewpoint, your knowledge set, and acknowledge them and say, okay, yes, here's how I feel about the subject matter, but X, Y, and Z. I have to acknowledge those things. And I've tried really hard to do that. I think people fare pretty well with that. I mean, the golf channels of the world do a pretty good job of that for however much longer Golf Channel exists. Golf Week, I think, does a pretty good job of that. Even though they sometimes just straight up copy my copy and put it on their website. I mean, they literally did it for the Masters. They copied one of my articles, which, hey, great. Thanks for doing that. But I think that's the ideal way to kind of, you have to stay consistent, and you can, your views can evolve, and maybe Dan's has, but I don't know if it's because he's thought about it critically or he's just been worn down. And I guess that's up to him to kind of explain or talk about the people, or just have a different arc, or maybe he's doing it for engagement. I don't know, but it feels like in this case, maybe some sports washing has started to work a little bit. All right. Want to wrap up this episode of the 19th Hole Golf Show with a conversation. And we've had a bunch of these recently. We started actually a podcast, a separate podcast for different types of conversations we had that air on GNN Radio. And there are two that recently I finally got my act together and got them onto Spotify and Apple Podcasts and stuff like that. One's called Green Shoots. Green Shoots is about golf entrepreneurialism, golf business. It really has started out as conversations with people who started small businesses in golf and have been seen some success and how they've done it and what that looks like and what challenges they face, and almost as kind of a way of picking the brains of people who have put their livelihood into golf and put their investment into golf and what that all looks like. But it really is a business-centric podcast, not necessarily about golf equipment. The other is called The Bag Room. And The Bag Room really is about equipment. It's deep dives into equipment development, R&D, function features, materials, sourcing materials, delivery, all kinds of different things with the people who are making the stuff that we use as golfers. Because I do find equipment really interesting. I also feel like I have a lot of curiosity about it, and not that I don't understand it, but that I can get a whole lot more from asking people about equipment and how it works and how it performs than just saying it on my own voice like I do here. And so I've really enjoyed putting those together. So the interview that I want to run today is actually from the Bag Room podcast, and it's with Dr. Dan Feeney from BOA. He is their director of biomechanics research, and he runs their performance fit lab out in Colorado. And I had Dan on for a Zoom chat, like a video chat, during the pandemic, like the earlier days of the pandemic. And he kind of took me through how the lab works, and we had a really, really interesting conversation, really engaging guy. So I wanted to have him on again to kind of talk about BOA footwear technology, BOA lacing system, the fit system that they have. It's, you've seen it on different golf footwear. It's very popular in other sports. Hiking, skiing has become popular. I mean, different walks of life, literally, pun intended. So I had a conversation with him where we talked about where BOA's at, his research, what he's learning, and hopefully you find that kind of interesting. I wanted to kind of put it all together for you as part of this episode. So enjoy the interview with Dr. Dan. Great to have you on again, Dan. Thanks for being with us. First, can you kind of give us a little bit of an update on some of the things that have evolved in the Performance Fit Lab, in particular at BOA? Because the last time we talked, that was a really impressive tour and impressive, really facility to understand what you guys are working on as a form of field research.
Thanks for having me, Ryan. Yeah, it's great to chat again. The Performance Fit Lab is about 5 years old now. And so with that, we've come a really far way. When we chatted last, one of the big things that we were interested in understanding was how different geometries of our panels that could be closed by BOA could basically make a shoe fit better. And so we were very interested in different panelizations. And so if you look at some of the products like the ZG21, the HyperFlex from FootJoy, you saw some different shapes of panels. From then, what we've really focused on has been understanding how different types of materials then interact with those different panels, and then even to interact with the different types of maybe players or motion somebody is looking for a shoe for. You know, for example, if you're really dealing with a power player that wants a ton of lockdown, that should be a different fit than maybe somebody that's more of a casual player that wants to be walking the course. They still want to be able to have lockdown when they want it, but they don't necessarily need that entirely aggressive lockdown, maybe for somebody that's driving 300 yards.
So in terms of the material that you've kind of figured out in what kind of makes and creates the best fit to interact with the BOA system, were you surprised by some of the results you've seen in the research and what kind of the outcomes there that could be meaningful for manufacturers of this equipment, of these shoes?
Absolutely. So as an ingredient brand, a lot of times we're not going to dictate the exact material somebody uses, at least at this point. We are, however, understanding what different types of materials and different material properties lead to better fit, right? So for example, within the lab, maybe we'll have somebody walking on uneven surfaces and we want to look at heel hold and ankle stability. Or maybe we'll have them doing a chipping shot on an uneven surface versus a drive. What we found across a number of different segments is there are certain areas where fit is really important. And so probably not too surprisingly, but the instep hold is really, really critical. And there's some level of forefoot fit that you want too. But actually, if you have too aggressive of a panel or too stiff of a material on the midfoot, basically the area between the instep and the forefoot, that can almost lead to claustrophobia and you don't get the foot moving as it's meant to move. And so you can actually have reductions in performance. One of the other really interesting things that we found is that depending on the type of person's foot, maybe they're going to be needing a different type of material that sort of matches the stiffness of their foot. And that's why inherently you see people choosing different products based on what feels good to them. So really when we come down to working with one of our brand partners, we will go to them and say, these are the types of characteristics of the materials that we know work well for this top strap or this bottom strap, for example, and then iterate with their design team to figure out within their materials library, which ones could we really bring to life.
Is some of that dictated by the shape of the last that they use in building this footwear so that, you know, someone might be more, a manufacturer might be more well-suited to someone who has maybe a steeper kind of build from the toe area to their ankle versus maybe a flatter look? Does that influence what kind of recommendations and that you guys make from BOA?
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the really interesting things within our lab is, of course, we do a lot of golf research, but we do research across a number of different segments. And so the trail running market is pretty interesting because we have a number of European brands and we have a number of US brands. And the fit profile of those lasts are very different. Typically in the US, you're dealing with a much wider toe box. That sort of tapers back towards the heel, whereas European brand, you tend to have a narrow heel and a narrow forefoot. So as a result, we find what are some different ways that you can accommodate those two different last types, because they have a consumer that wants that. But how can you then use the right type of material so that it provides sort of the lockdown where you want it? And then in that instep or that midfoot area, making sure you don't ever get too claustrophobic.
Are there any brands that make significant changes in the last design to accommodate BOA versus maybe a lace version of their shoe?
We do see a number of brands that will make different last shapes. And I would say the bigger difference for us is typical shoes, as you might know, for a very long time, most shoes have a U throat, right? So if you look at the manufacturer of the shoe, there's a big U cut down the middle. That's to accommodate laces. And what we found is there's probably better ways to make a shoe if you don't just have to accommodate a lace. So instead of maybe just last shape changing, what we're working with brands to do is how can we think of other construction methods? So whether it's a burrito wrap, whether it's sort of more like a sock type construction, these things allow our panels to get close to your foot. And it also overcomes some of the barriers that are just sort of inherent limitations in cutting a shoe down the middle and making you in it.
Have more brands been willing to at least embrace or have conversations with BOA, maybe in the golf space that didn't before in the last couple of years, having seen what you guys have done with Adidas and FootJoy in particular?
Yes, definitely. And I think one of the keys with us is we want to work really deeply with the brands that want to collaborate at this level, right? So our collaborations with Adidas and with FootJoy take a lot of time. And so we're very intimately related with their product design development team, right? We know that that creates products in the end market that consumers love and they have a good experience with. We don't ever really just want to go chase the mass market and say, well, here we're just going to copy paste this idea and then ultimately maybe have a product that people don't like. So we are always working with brands, but it's this delicate balance of wanting to make sure that we can really be collaborative partners and we can give all of the work that we're doing in the lab, all of the work that our teams are doing from a design development side, just to make sure that the brand can take all of their knowledge on footwear and we can collaborate and make a really good product.
What In terms of the collaborative research that you do with these brands, how much of that becomes knowledge sharing that kind of goes more broadly, or how much of it is proprietary that's just kind of a handshake agreement between you and that brand?
Yeah, most of the work we do in the lab, we do actually is BOA-driven research. So we have a research program over the next 2, 5, 10 years that we want to understand, like I was talking about, different geometries, different materials. And even we want to have a point of view on other parts of the shoe. So whether it's carbon fiber inserts, whether it's different foams, things like that, we want to come to the table already having studied that in some way. And the benefit to that is that research, then we can disseminate to all of our brand partners and say, these are what we've learned. We also have another part of our research program where when we're developing a really critical model, you know, I think like the ZG23 is a good one. We can work with Adidas to make sure that that shoe gets tested in the lab against maybe the previous version of that shoe or even multiple iterations of the same shoe. So we can have true golfers come in, we test it, we look at performance variables, but we also look at qualitative feedback and we look at pressure across the entire foot. And so we can give that feedback to the brand. That, of course, is going to be a more of a proprietary handshake relationship. But that is probably a slightly smaller portion than our bigger, we'll just say, like innovative research program that we've got a pretty long scope that we just want to understand because we think it makes us better partners.
And does that help from a perspective of a brand that might be new to BOA saying that we don't really know the integration, but obviously you guys have tons of data that can help inform these decisions for us as we get started with it?
Exactly. And so, you know, getting a new brand up to speed is challenging on a variety of levels. I would say my level is almost the easiest because we've now done so much research. We are testing about 750 tests in the lab each year. So we're in there twice a day, every day, pretty darn often. So we have a lot of data. And so from my side, we can work with the brand and say, we know that these angles of the laces, of the panels work well or don't work well. We have an entire second part of our group that works with factory integration, right? And so it's one thing to make one version of a shoe that fits really well. It's an entire separate thing to go through the commercialization process and manufacture something at scale. And BOA also handles that. So those are two paths. And maybe it's because I'm in the research side, but I think my side's a little bit easier.
I think this was maybe the last time that we talked, but I can't remember, but there's been more usage of different types of material that run through the BOA system, knit material versus kind of coated metal material. Has there been any development on that that kind of changes or skews one way to the other in how people choose to implement what actually runs through the BOA system, the fitting system?
Yeah. So the laces, is that what you're primarily talking about? Yep. Yeah. So we have a variety of different lace types really for different applications. I think when you look at some of the other sports outside of golf, for example, getting into trail, we knew that we couldn't use more of our stainless steel coated lace. It just, for most consumers, perception wise, it wasn't going to make sense. Performance wise, as far as fit, I don't think it would make a huge difference there. We are continuously evolving though. And one of our big areas, along with many, is understanding how we can be more renewably sourced and make sure that none of the products that are going into our product are harming the earth. So that's really our big evolution probably over the next 5 to 10 years, is understanding how we can use renewably sourced materials, how we can create new products that are not harming the earth in any way.
What does that research look like in terms of kind of tensile material? I mean, how are you trying to evaluate what from a renewably sourced perspective could work? How does that
lay out in the performance lab? So we have just like our performance fit lab, we have an engineering durability and testing lab. And so they're working really closely with our material science and sort of this innovation team where we want to understand, we have certain product attributes that we really stand behind, right? Like BOA has a lifetime guarantee. So any shoe, if anything breaks, we'll always replace it. And we want to stand by that. Because of that, we have certain benchmark tests, and you hit on one exactly, right? Like we have a certain max amount of tension that should be able to go into a lace, and that should have a safety factor well above anything a user is going to do. So that's going to be one of the tests. You know, say we have a renewably sourced material that's going to go into a lace or into a guide or even just a dial. We need to understand how strong is that material going to be, and is it going to last over the course of different environments? So whether you're golfing, maybe in the Midwest, then it's going to be very wet all the time. maybe somebody is out in a desert like Moab and you're going to have these arid conditions. So those are all the tests that we're actually doing, and we're running them on a daily basis also in our other testing engineering lab.
Can you give us an example of something you're working on specific to golf, or that you have on the docket that maybe you're particularly excited about, or what makes you particularly excited about what you're doing in the lab right now?
Yeah, I alluded to this a little bit earlier, but we actually just published a study in trail running. And I keep harping to this because it was a big finding for us. But we actually took people out onto the trails and we had them run, and we did a bunch of biomechanics research. So we looked at heel hold, we looked at ankle stability, we looked at efficiency, and we found some really nice benefits from our rep. We have a project that we're planning this summer where we're going to take a lot of those learnings that we found on the trail and then apply them into golf, for example. So obviously people that are walking 18 holes, the fit of the footwear, your heel hold, your ankle stability is really important walking. But of course, if you are maybe not hitting a ball off a perfectly manicured spot, that also is something where we think that probably the fit of the footwear really comes into play. And that's been the central reinforcing thesis that we keep learning time and time again. Is the more extreme or the more aggressive a condition, the more fit really matters. And so our next step in golf is just understanding how we can take that and then apply it to different configurations and working with our brand partners as they're developing products that maybe hit a certain niche of consumer.
Last question to kind of wrap it all up and put your research in kind of totality. What are the biggest parallels you see between golf and other activities, whether that's, like you said, trail running, trail walking, hiking, skiing? I mean, I don't know where the biggest parallels are. I mean, you kind of mentioned the common thread of the more extreme condition, the more fit matters. But are there other parallels that you found in your research between golf and other sports?
Absolutely. The ones you talked about are some of the first ones that come to mind. I think another big one is workwear. So we have a very big workwear market, especially in Europe and Northern Europe. People are wearing these shoes for 8, 12, 14 hours a day, right? And so the ability to get a micro-adjustable fit that fits exactly how you want it as your foot changes shape over the course of the day is something that we're really interested in. And I think it absolutely applies to golf. In addition, Alpine was one of the biggest things that kind of came through our building over the past 5 years. And so there's certainly a lot of learnings that we're taking from that, both on the biomechanics side, as well as on the product development side. We had to create an entirely new product to make Alpine work. And as a result, we took a ton of learnings from that. And like I said, whether it's sustainability or whether it's just understanding different geometries within our dial that could actually make it more effective, these are a bunch of things that we're now trickling into our other segments.
Dan, thanks for taking some time to talk with us about kind of all things that you're working on. I mean, there's a lot of excitement in that research area, I feel like, especially from you guys. So congrats on the published study first. And then thanks for spending some time to kind of bring it to golf for all of us.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Thank you to Dan Feeney for being on the show. I don't think he realized he was going to be on this show too, but you can also listen to the interview in full and all the ones that I've done. And we have more coming out all the time. If you subscribe to the Bag Room podcast, and again, I would encourage you to check out Green Shoots as well over at Golf News Net Radio over on golfnewsnet.com. You find it there or the podcasting service of your choice. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. Last show in my 30s and wrapping up year 40 here on Earth. I'm incredibly grateful for the life I've been able to live. And if nothing else, my birthday always feels like an opportunity to be grateful for the things that I've worked toward and the people who have helped me and the people who mean a lot to me. And I say this quite frequently, but I obviously can't do what I do without your support and without your help and your encouragement and your criticism. Makes me better. It drives me, keeps me going. And I'm eternally grateful for that. So thank you. It's an incredible everyday gift to be able to get to do this for a living. And I do not take that lightly. So thank you. We'll be back next week with another show. Talk about all kinds of other stuff, I'm sure. Someone will say something silly or stupid, and we'll talk about that. Digging on some things about life, and might even include part of a conversation that I had about putters that frankly will blow your mind. At least it has blown mine for several days now. But maybe play it over the next couple of episodes. Split it up into two. I think you'll really enjoy it. Until next time, I'm Ryan Ballengee. Thank you for listening. We will catch you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.